As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm John McKenzie and I'm joined today by John McKenzie. Hi, John.
I would never say podcast. Come on.
No, that's true. Sorry. Podcast. How's it going? You all right?
Just a podcast. Yeah, really, really good. And all the better for seeing you there on the other side of the mic.
That's right. My big face. Now, my big face spent a very enjoyable period of time, to be determined by the editor today, listening to you talk all about shots. Shots and goals. And sometimes just shots. And all different Premier League players. And the exciting bit is that it's all buried in the second half, so make sure that you stay to listen to John talking about specific players. Specifically, I have to say, my favourite bit, when we start talking about Odson Edouard, Crystal Palace striker, I quite liked that, and I don't like football. So I think if you stick around for those bits, that'd be great. But if you could pray-see, and I mean pray-see, John, what we talked about in today's episode, what would you say off the back of a huge amount of research that you undertook with no one asking you to?
Yeah, so basically I logged timings for all of the Premier League primary strikers because I was interested to see how timing and touches influence a player's ability to score goals, essentially. And a lot of it was done in the context of thinking, actually, we use expected goal models to just mainly think that shot location is the most important thing. Therefore, we can just discount every other aspect of a striker's sort of shooting action. And with this, I just wanted to push back a little bit and see if there was anything I could learn from it.
Okay, now let me translate that to the people listening. John spent 500 hours, no, not that. John spent several hours logging 500 different shots from all different Premier League strikers so that he could learn about what's better to do in football and what is not better to do in football. And some of the learnings from that, are actually very interesting. And some of them are tediously dull. But don't worry, I'm here to hurry things along. And with that in mind, should we just crack straight on with the episode?
I think so.
Okay. Now. Now, John, you have decided in all of your, I don't know, infinite wisdom to spend hours and hours of your professional time, time that you're paid for, by the way, just as a quick reminder, to watch footballers score goals, haven't you? Why have you done that?
I mean, I did a lot of the watching outside of my working hours as well. So let's turn that right back onto you from the off. But
Mike, we'll just, producer Mike, we'll just snip that out, but go on, John.
Yes, so in the end, I've watched over 500 shots in the Premier League this season. yeah, and what I was essentially doing with those shots was logging timing and touches, which is something that I don't have access to the data on. So I just sort of figured, let's find it out myself. But this was all, I guess, prompted by some of the comments that I saw from Alan Shearer after one of Arsenal's games where they struggled in front of goal. And he was spending a lot of time talking about how the players should have basically got the ball away quicker when they were shooting. If they'd have taken their shots quicker, they would have had more joy in front of goal. I also came across...
It's something you hear from pundits quite a lot, isn't it? Like, you know, get it out from under you.
Yeah, and something that I think I found working on this is that a lot of people who work in the game, they view the shooting actions very much in those sorts of terms. So then I think we'll go on to talk a lot about how a lot of ideas about shooting are now influenced by the concept of expected goals, expected goals models. But what I found talking to people who are actually coaching is, yes, they'll talk about shot location, which is a big part of what XG models work off. So where the basically the place of the pitch where you're taking your shot from. But I think if you are a coach and you're working, or an analyst and you're working for a club on the pitch, you obviously don't just say, well, make sure you're shooting from the best locations. If you do that, everything else will follow. The emphasis is much more on technique. Things like, can you take a few of your touches out here? Can you get the shot away as quickly as possible? And, you know, a lot of this all ties back into itself as well, because I think if you analyze what goes into a lot of expected goals models, particularly at the elite end of the game, so the companies who are providing expected goal data to professional clubs, a lot of them will take into account defensive positioning and goalkeeper positioning at the point at which the shot is taken. So if there's more players between you and the goalkeeper when you take your shot, then it's likely that that chance will be a lower value chance, which indicates, I think, intrinsically this idea that if you can get your shot away quicker, the opposition will have less time to position defenders in between you and the goal. The goalkeeper can have better time to set their feet. So this was the sort of premise that I was working with. Why do we not talk about...
Surprise. The premise of surprise.
The premise of surprise, yeah. Why do we not talk about the touches that are taken before shots? And it's worth saying at this point, actually, as maybe a bit of an aside, when data gatherers talk about touches, and you'll see, you know, people will put out data saying this player had this amount of touches during a game. Intrinsically, you think, well, that means how many times have they actually physically touched the ball? But that's not actually true. Most of the time, what that figure represents is the amount of actions that they've had on the ball, right? So if a player receives the ball, turns, does a dribble, and then passes, they may get three touches for each one of those events. Whereas what I'm interested in is literally the amount of physical touches that a player takes before they shoot the ball. So it's worth just clarifying that at the outset, because I think a lot of people don't realize that. So when most data gatherers use the word touches, what they actually mean is actions or events. But I was kind of asking, why do we not think about those? And that's part of the reason why we don't think about touches as much, because the word touches has a different meaning depending on
touches doesn't even mean touches.
Yeah, exactly. Which is
what a world we live in, John. What a very world. Confusing.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is it's interesting. It leads me on to my next question, because I don't know about you. I've always thought that XG is a bit of a dangerous catch-all for shooting opportunities, for reasons such as the ones that you kind of novicely explained just there. Would you like to try a little harder to evaluate that?
Yeah, so an expected goals model, essentially all it's doing is taking all of the shots that we have in a data set. So you may go back a few seasons across a few different leagues and you'll say, this is all the shot data that we have. We know what's happened in these scenarios. And you'll have a number of different variables that you're putting into those models. So the most important one being the XY variables, which is literally the position on the pitch that the shot is taken from. And that makes a...
Is that represented in like a number, like a coordinate?
Yeah, almost? An XY coordinate. Right, yeah. Right. So
okay.
The data gatherers will log the location of the shot and it will be represented as an XY coordinate. And obviously that's the most important one, right? Because the closer you are to goal, the more likely you are to score. Obviously there's other variables that come into that. We've talked about things like defensive positioning, but the ball height or the kind of pass that has gone into the box, if it's a cross, it's going to be much harder to finish than if it's a cut back along the floor, for example.
And how do they add that? Is there a Z in there for when it's above the ground?
Yeah,
the third dimension.
I guess so. I know that StatsBomb use shot the height of the ball when the shot's taken as a variable, right, as well. So I guess they just add another axis onto their analysis.
What happens when they enter the fourth dimension?
Well, that's what I'm doing, right? Because the fourth dimension is time, right? So I'm wanting to assess how the timing comes into it a little bit more. But the problem is that because shot location is the primary factor, it's going to influence the likelihood of a goal being scored much more than the other factors. There's a tendency for people, I think, in analysis to focus on shot location as the only thing that really matters, right? As long as you're getting good shots, as long as you're getting shots away in good locations, you don't need to worry about it too much. Now, obviously, as XG models have got more advanced, there's more and more variables being added to them, but that principle is going to remain the same pretty much all the way through. It's most important that you're getting shots from good places. But I think what I was wanting to interrogate a little bit more was, okay, we know that shot location is important, but is shot location important just by dint of the fact that you're closer to the goal? Or is there a sense in which if you're getting shots away in good locations, you're actually able to do some of these other things that we've talked about a little bit better? So the timing of the shot, you're able to take fewer touches before you get your shots away. And so I just wanted to dig into the data a little bit more and find out what I could about shot timing in particular.
Okay, so let's go back to the beginning then. You said you watched about 500 shots.
Mm-hmm.
Take us through one. What are you logging? What? Because you're doing. You said at the beginning that this is data that you don't have access to. By which you mean that at The Athletic we have data provision from certain companies that do this gathering and then sell the data to either publishers, media groups like us or to teams directly. This isn't something that we have available. So you've gathered it yourself. Mm-hmm. Well done. Good job. What were you actually gathering? What were you noting down for each of these goals that you watched or shots that you watched?
Yeah, I should clarify and say we may have access to some of this data, but actually in part, one of the reasons I wanted to gather the data myself is because then I had a much better...
Because you don't trust the data providers. You think you're better than them.
Yeah, I don't think they're as good at...
You're sending a message today to the King, Opta King and StatsBomb people to say, I know what you've done.
Yeah, it was more just that I had a sense of exactly what the data I was logging looked like and how it translated into the tape itself. So, I went through and essentially I went on Y Scout and I went through all of a player's shots, essentially, in the Premier League. So that doesn't count.
What's Y Scout?
Y Scout is a subscription service online which basically has access to the tape from the games that teams play, but they also cut up the tape so that you can search by action for each player, right? So any sort of action, the thing that we talked about before as touches. So anything that a player is doing on the ball, which you could say that's a tackle, that's a shot, that's a cross, they clip it up so you can search for all of a player's, I don't know, defensive actions if you want to, if you're a scout and you want to just compress it all together. Yeah, so I went through and I searched by shot, and it's worth clarifying that shots don't include penalties in my data set, and they don't include headers either, which I think makes a degree of sense, but it didn't matter too much for me because obviously a header is almost always going to be a one touch. In fact, I've never seen a two touch header where someone's headed it and then or passed it to themselves.
I bet
and
there's one out
there. There must be.
Please tweet directly to John McKenzie to let him know about the two header goals.
Yes.
I can think of some players falling over backwards, having one controlling touch and then another. Knock. It happens in Rocket League all the time.
I've seen, I actually saw one yesterday where someone takes a shot. The ball comes in, it's a crossfield pass right across the face of the goal. The player shoots, but hits it into their own head, and then it bounces in. So there are examples of that happening. So, but it's good for you to hold me to account. I should be clear.
That's
about
what I'm here for.
Yeah. So I started off with me going through all of actually Kai Havertz and Gabriel Jesus's chances because I was doing this for an Arsenal video that I was thinking about. And then I thought, well, I've got to compare them to Erling Haaland, right, who is the gold standard of what you should do if you're a striker and you're trying to score goals. And then
you knew that just because he scores goals or because you knew about his technique? Are you working like backwards from the fact that he has results or just because you assume that he's good?
I worked backwards from the fact that, well, actually, initially it wasn't the Arsenal thing that I was interested in. I was interested in the difference between Darwin Nunez and Haaland. And I wondered if there was anything in timing that could show why Haaland is more likely to finish his chances than Darwin Nunez. So I started off with all of Darwin Nunez's chances and then I looked at Haaland because I was like, Haaland just scores a lot of goals, right? And he doesn't do much else other than get in the box and score goals. So I figured that he was going to be the gold standard. And my research does confirm that. Like, if you want to be a good goal scorer, be more like Erling Haaland, which I don't think is particularly groundbreaking research, really.
Yeah. I think they call that confirmation bias.
I then added Gabriel Jesus and Havertz because I did this Arsenal video looking at whether or not Arsenal should should be thinking about shot timing if they want to improve their goal scoring this season. And then, you know, I just slowly started adding more strikers in there, just to get a better sense of, you know, what was standard amongst Premier League strikers. And I ended up logging the primary strikers of all 20 Premier League teams. I wish I could have done all of the strikers in the Premier League, but it would have taken ages.
Plus, it's not just like shots aren't exclusive to strikers.
Sure, sure. And yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that later on, I think, because, you know, people were asking me whether or not, for example, 80% of goals that are scored come from one or two touches. And people were saying, yeah, well, that makes sense because the majority of chances are going to be one or two touch chances. So I can tell you exactly what percentage of shots that Premier League strikers are having, and it is under 80%. So what you should be trying to do as a Premier League team is generating good chances that you can take with one or two touches. But we'll get into that a little bit more when we talk about Richarlison. But yeah, as I've ended up with a big data set from all of those things, and the things that I was logging, you might be interested to hear. It's just three things basically. So for each chance, I log the difference in time between the first touch and then the shot, which I'm calling timing here. So whenever I'm talking about timing, I'm literally just talking about the amount of seconds between a first touch and a shot. Then I'm logging.
Let's pause there for 1 second.
Okay.
Now, I'm imagining that you're sat there with a little stopwatch, pressing the button with your thumb. Are you just doing it based on the video?
Yeah.
With the time on the video?
Yeah.
Okay. And is this to a decimal point, or are you just full fat seconds?
Two decimal points.
Two decimal points?
Yes. And
wow,
you'd be amazed, actually, because I did quite a bit of like control testing. And a lot of the times when I felt, you know, that it was an important number to be logging, I would do it twice. And you'd be amazed at how consistent it actually is just doing it that way. Obviously, it's not very accurate. But I also figured that because it was just me who was logging all the numbers, if it was out on anything, it would be consistently out. So, yeah, take it with a pinch of salt. But again, I just wanted to have a sense of like the speed at which strikers are generally getting the ball away after they take touches.
For sure. I think it's just important as we're listening through this that the audience are able to imagine you in your habitat. So was it pants or did you have trousers as well when you were doing this? You said you were doing some of it outside of work time. Fully clothed
at all moments, I think. Yeah.
Were you wearing a tie or?
No tie, no. I was quite casual with it, but.
And you know how your glasses rest on the tip of your nose sometimes. Did you slid them down for that extra level of football-related seduction?
That's right, yeah.
Or was it just normal?
Closer the glasses are to the screen, the more accurate the reading, I was fine.
Okay, we're all there with you now. Tell us what you logged number two, Mr. Beaver.
Number two is just touches. So like I say, every time a player touches the ball after receiving it before shooting. So touches here.
Okay, question.
Yeah, go.
I'm going to pause you every time. Now, question. With a touch, what if a player did a scoop where they held the ball on their foot? Is that one touch? Is it two touches? Were there any scoops?
There were no scoops, to my knowledge. There was a couple of times where a player would have the ball kicked against them.
A bobble, yeah.
And then sometimes, there was a few times where a player had a shot and then it bounced back off the goalkeeper, and then I just counted it as the next shot as a one-touch shot rather than the series. So, but that's the extent to which touches were complicated.
Because a shot is a touch.
A shot is a touch, yeah. That's what I'm calling it.
Okay.
So a one-touch shot is just receiving the ball and shooting without taking a prior touch. A two-touch shot is taking the setting touch and then taking the shot.
Yeah. Okay, fine. And mine would be a 17-touch shot, but that's for a different podcast.
I didn't have any 17-touch shots in my database. yeah.
What's the height? To be fair, though, at this point, what is the highest touch number pre-goal?
I think, before a goal, that's a different thing entirely. I think maybe about five or six touches was the most before a goal in the Premier League.
Really?
Six touches I've got here. Six touches. Evan Ferguson took six touches for the second goal in his hat-trick against Newcastle.
Do you remember that goal? What were the circumstances?
Usually, whenever there's a lot of touches before a goal, what happens is they take it around the goalkeeper. But I'm pretty sure that all of Evan Ferguson's goals in that hat-trick were from distance. So he must have dribbled around a player, reset himself, and then taken the shot.
A cool goal.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. But, no, that's good. Right, yeah. Carry on.
And the other thing I logged was whether or not a goal was the result of the action as well. Although I haven't really done much interrogation into the relationship between goals and touches and timing, because I think it becomes very clear quite quickly that there's no correlation between the amount of touches you take and how many goals you're scoring, which is, I guess, something we can start to come on to now in terms of what it was that I found from the data.
Oh, that's confused me. Okay, fine. What did you find from the data then?
Well, in terms of timing, I think the big confusion that is going to arise is that obviously players are playing in different systems, and different systems are going to try and generate chances for their strikers in different ways. So, for example, Erling Haaland takes shots quite quickly with few touches. He is also a striker who plays off the last man, stays roughly between the width of the penalty box, and you know, if he does drop in, it's not to pick up the ball, turn and then run towards the goal. It's to lay the ball off and then get into a dangerous goal scoring situation. And part of the reason why he's so dangerous is because he plays that role for a team that are very good at generating those kind of chances in Man City.
I was going to say, that's probably like really key, right? He's surrounded by players who are able to put it on a dime for him.
If you so he gets 14 goals in so far this season. If you compare him to a player like Alexander Isak, who is playing for Newcastle, who has 10 goals, so still like high volume goal scorer relative to the system, he is one of the players who has the lowest number of touches, sorry, the highest number of touches before shooting in the league. So let me just pull up the table. So yeah, he is the slowest shot taker in terms of touches. So 3.57 touches per shot from him so far this season. He's just behind Gabriel Jesus, who's on 3.04. Now, both of those players, I think if you talk about the team play style, it becomes interesting, right? Because Alexander Isak is playing for a direct team. We've seen him pick the ball up in wide areas and dribble towards the goal. So there's a lot of situations where he's getting a lot of touches before the final shot goes away. And Gabriel Jesus...
Or even you just expect him to be further away from the goal when he picks generally. The ball up. Even if he's in a number nine position, if they're defending, then he wouldn't be as close to the attacking goal.
Yeah, and you know, they're not a team who are doing high possession stuff, so it's not that they can possess the ball in the final third and he can just sit in, as we've said, between the centre backs and wait for the ball to arrive. Actually, a lot of the time, because they're playing so dynamically, if he picks the ball up deep, the idea is that he tries to get towards the goal as quickly as possible. So that's obviously inflating his touches. And then Gabriel Jesus is playing a very much false nine position for Arsenal, right? Which is, he's dropping off and becoming quite a creative player, likes to receive the ball, particularly in the left half space. And a lot of times, you know, he'll pick the ball up and then try and fashion a shot for himself. So his touches per shot is quite high. But interestingly enough, if you compare him, and what I did is I compared all of the strikers in my data set against two touch shot samples, because the idea then was like, okay, given that team play style is so important here, can I isolate the sorts of shots that are quite similar to see whether or not the timing is notably different for these different players. So two touch shot, as I said before, you receive the ball, take a setting touch and then take the shot, which you would expect to be a sort of fairly similar action for most players as well. So you've got a bit of repeatability there. And then as soon as you start looking at those numbers, it's quite interesting how quick some of these players jump up. So two-touch timing, the quickest player is Erling Haaland, 0.7 seconds per two-touch shot. He's the quickest by a long way. But Gabriel Jesus now has... And Haaland in the touches per shot is really high as well, right? So he's 1.83, I should say, rounding up, touches per shot. So right, the opposite end of the scale to Isak and Gabriel Jesus. He's right at the top when it comes to timing, so he's getting his shots away quickest in the touch shot sample. But now we've got Gabriel Jesus and Alexander Isak at 6 and 7, so they're in those scenarios where they're only taking two touches before shooting, they're actually much quicker than a lot of other Premier League strikers. And in my hypothesis, that is why Alexander Isak is scoring a lot of goals. Gabriel Jesus, the sample size is a little bit skewed because he's not taking as many, so it's hard to read anything from it. But the takeaway that I get from that is maybe if he took more two-touch chances, he would be getting a higher volume of shots, because a lot of the time when he's having these shots, he's doing them around crowded boxes because he's picked the ball up deeper. The opposition have been able to set themselves defensively, and so they, those chances become much lower value chances in those moments.
So this goes back to what you were saying at the beginning then, where like the instinct in the mind of a striker when they have the ball on, maybe let's just say just inside the box, but the box is crowded because their team has had high possession. Mm-hmm. The instinct would be to shift it around until you get the right angle and take more touches in doing so. But are you saying that probably what's better is to try to get the shot away quicker when the team, even though they might be in the way, they're not prepared?
Yeah, so I think it's really important with all of this data to not just try and use it prescriptively in the way that Charles Reap did with the data that he had back in the 1950s, where it was like most goals are scored from one or two or three passes. So you shouldn't ever try and pass more than two or three times. Like if the right. takeaway that people are getting from the data I'm producing is, well, players should just shoot as quickly as possible because it's, you're more likely to score from that. Well, obviously that's not true, because you have to be in a good goal scoring position for that to be the case. So that's just a caveat to get out there. Everything that I've said about shot location prior to this is true. It remains true. All we're trying to say is, within that, what can we learn from shot timing? And I think, as a general rule, if you're in a position where the ball arrives at you around the penalty spot, in almost all cases, it's going to be better for you to try and get the shot off within one or two touches than it is to hold onto the ball a little bit longer. So I've just put out a Kai Havertz video, which is available across all of our platforms at the moment, where we looked at... it's about Arsenal's finishing, as I've already said, but we start that off by looking at a chance that he has where, if he takes the first touch shot, so just plays it straight away, it's just the goalkeeper between him and the goal. But then he takes three more touches before shooting, and at that point there's now five defenders and the goalkeeper between him and the goal. So obviously it's going to be harder to score that. So as a general rule, yes, I think if you can get shots away quicker, then you're going to be a more dangerous goal scorer. But with Erling Haaland, for example, if we look at that data on that two-touch shot sample, we can see that one of the reasons why he is so dangerous a goal scorer is because he is taking those two-touch chances quicker than anyone else in the data set. So, he has the ability to take the setting touch and then the shot quicker than most other players. So that means necessarily that he is going to be able to just get the benefit of that shot going off. It's a fraction of a second, but it's a fraction of a second where the team could be getting into a better defensive position. The goalkeeper could be setting themselves.
Okay, let's talk about this by team now, because I think that's going to interest people. No,
I was going
to
say no.
You're
making
a little face, aren't you?
I want to push.
Tell the listening audience about the face you just made. What face was it?
It was a disgruntled face.
Your mouth went
face.
All small.
Yes,
I've a got, little open.
I've got things that I want to talk about before we start talking about teams.
Oh, good lord!
So the first
what
thing
are they? List. No, bullet point them to me, and then I shall decide.
Okay.
Don't forget, I'm the host on this episode, John.
Yeah, it is true. It's hard to let my baby into your hands again, but yeah. The first thing we should talk about is the fact that timing is different to shot location, because in shot location, it's always better to be closer to the goal. It's always going to make you like more likely to score. Whereas with shot timing, it's not quite that simple, right? Because you can have negative effects by shooting quicker. So we should talk about that. We should also talk about touches as well before we get to everything else, because I want to talk about Richarlison and the kind of chances that he's taking.
Okay. I've decided to talk about the first thing you said first.
Yes.
So you're now welcome to do that.
Yeah, so I think that the reason why it becomes complicated is because, as we said before, if you want to say getting shots off quicker is generally the best thing to do, the logical corollary of that is, oh, you should just try and get your shots off as quickly as possible. But obviously...
like Ronaldo did against Porto in the 2007 Champions League, whatever that was. You know, that one from 40 yards.
Is that the last time you watched a football game? 2007?
Yes.
But obviously there's diminishing returns to speed, right? So the general principle that I operate now when watching strikers' shots is, yes, if you can get the shot away as quickly as possible, then do it, but you shouldn't do that in such a way that compromises on your actual shooting action, right? Because if players try and shoot too quickly, it can have a negative effect on the biomechanics of their shot. Erling Haaland is the best at best ball striker in a goal scoring situation because he can take those shots quicker without compromising on his ball striking mechanic. There's a couple of players who show up quite high on my data in the timing per shot category. So Neil Mope is number two after Richarlison, and he's on 0.4665. That's the average amount of time that he takes on the ball before he shoots it. He's getting the ball away really quickly. But as we know, Neil Mope isn't necessarily a high volume finisher. I think he gets the benefit of, you know, getting his shots away quickly because he will occasionally connect well and beat the goalkeeper, beat the defence. But a lot of the time you can also see that there's problems with his shooting technique because he tries to shoot too quickly as well. So it's about about getting the combination of things right. You want to be in good shooting positions. You want to take the shot as quickly as possible, but without compromising your shooting biomechanics.
Okay, that makes sense. So and Richarlison leads that chart.
Richarlison leads a lot of the data, actually.
This is interesting to me because at the beginning of the season, when Ange Postecoglou was... Is that when he arrived at the beginning of the season, Ange Postecoglou?
Well, beginning of preseason.
There were a lot of people in my life, you being one of them, your friends being the others, who got very excited about Richarlison and what he might play like in an Ange Postecoglou team. And then I got to enjoy for, I would say, 3 months, him not really doing that and calling you all stupid before I've had to bite my own tongue because things have started working out for him, haven't they? It might be nice to set a little bit of context around that, John, before we go on to talk about his touches.
Yeah, so as I said before, I think 80% of goals that are scored in the Premier League are scored with one or two touches. And I think if you once you realise that, you recognise that actually a big part of having a successful goal-scoring team is to generate those kind of one or two-touch chances. Now, not just any one or two-touch chances. I'm not saying people should shoot from kickoff, right, because shot location is important. So it's about generating repeatable chances that strikers can get off within one or two touches within dangerous goal-scoring opportunities.
So that's not just into the good location, but it's also a pass that makes it finds the striker in their stride so that they can take as few settling touches as possible before getting that shot away.
Yeah, so Martin Ødegaard is a really good example of that, right? How many times do you see the ball being cut back from the byline to him on the edge of the box and he just puts it into the far corner with a first touch shot? That kind of idea. Richarlison is interesting because Ange Postecoglou's system is famous for actually using its nine in a very sort of limited way. So I remember last season when he was at Celtic, I think on average, Kyogo Furuhashi was taking less than 15 touches in the classic sense of the word. So 15 actions on the ball every game, which is really, really, really low. I think Richarlison early on in the season took like 27 touches in a game and he was the player on the pitch with the fewest touches. So 14 point whatever it was as an average is incredibly low, and that's because Ange Postecoglou's whole system is designed to generate those sorts of one or two touch chances in the penalty area that are dangerous. And so the role of the striker in his system is largely to stay in those areas between the two centre backs, often pushing the offside line as much as you can to try and generate space between the lines for your teammates. But the general idea is to be in that position to score those chances when they emerge.
To put it in the bleeding net.
Yeah, exactly. His job is simply to be a goal scorer. And so with that in mind, I then looked at the Richarlison data and I've analysed 27 shots that he's had that are non-headed, non-penalties this season. 26 of them were one or two touch shots. And the one that wasn't was a three-touch shot that he took against Liverpool. I think he was playing technically as an outside forward anyway at that point. So the data was really interesting to me, not because... And we've made a video on this as well, which is, again, available on all of our channels. But the data is interesting to me, not because it's like, oh, well, look, clearly Richarlison is the best striker. And it's great that he's in Ange Postecoglou's system because it's, you know, he's the best striker they could possibly get. Instead, actually, the logic almost works the other way around. And you could say we learn a lot about the system from the way that Richarlison is playing it, because the system is designed to get one or two chances. And that is almost exclusively the kind of chance that Richarlison is getting. So Richarlison is a perfect profile of player for that kind of system. And as a result, if you actually look at his underlying numbers, he's had the most productive season in front of goal in his whole career.
And
again,
he's the perfect profile story because we knew that he took a few touches before shots before in his career, or for another reason. Because, how did you know, like at the beginning of the season, that this was going to happen?
Because he fits that profile of a player who doesn't need to do a huge amount other than exist in those spaces, be disciplined to not drop off the front line. So we saw a few times in pre-season, Harry Kane still playing at Spurs in that system, and his tendency is always, because of what's happened in the past to a degree, but because he's also one of the greatest footballers who's ever lived, to drop out of the front line, to pick the ball up and to, you know, pull the strings creatively. If you
do
that,
more of a complete player.
Sure. And if you do that, then sure, it may help them to generate more of these one or two touch chances, but he's not going to be in the area to finish them off, right? Because there's a few examples in pre-season where he would drop in, help the movement, they would generate the chance, and there would be no striker in that central space where he can score from. So a really nice example, because it shows how, if your system is designed to generate these dangerous one or two touch shots, you would think that it would make you more likely to score more goals. But that's true. And then when we look at Richarlison's data, we can see the system is actually working, because Richarlison is getting those one or two touch shots in the majority of situations. He's converting a lot of them into goals as well. I think it's 5 goals that he scored from those sorts of situations. It's not just him scoring from headers, although headers, I think, in this situation count as well, because it's him playing off the shoulder of the centre-backs in those dangerous areas. But it's just a really nice way of showing, of the data showing why Ange Postecoglou's system is so dangerous, because it recognises this is what a team needs to do to score goals, so let's do it and have the right kind of profile of striker in those situations to then score those chances.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
It's quite interesting though, isn't it? Because it makes me think about what fans or viewers want out of football players and how we remember players as iconic. Because when you think about all of the best, you know, all these lists of the best strikers in the history of football, I think of players like Brazilian Ronaldo, Zlatan Ibrahimovic at his peak, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo also in there, Messi, of course. The moments that we remember that define them as those iconic great strikers are the moments where either they take a shitload of touches and dribble it around people and do something which no one else can do. They do something incredibly acrobatic or shoot from a really long distance, which, you know, is the opposite of what we're talking about here. And I even think, like, with Erling Haaland, he's becoming iconic because of the number of goals that he scores and because of how he looks, right? Not really because of how he plays. You can see, like, his athleticism, his size, his physicality on the pitch is exciting to watch to a certain extent. And it's nice to see someone express like that level of physical prowess over an opponent, you know, in a kind of like Olympic way. That's fun to watch. But I can't think of a goal that he scored that really makes me sort of stand up from my seat. Do you know what I mean? Like, is this a part of like the evolution of how goals are scored in football, of more like team goals as opposed to those iconic strikers? Or am I just looking back on the past with rose-tinted glasses and remembering like individual iconic moments from very long careers?
No, not at all. I think there's two different ways that you can solve problems on a football pitch, right? One of them is to offer structural solutions via coaching to get the team to do things that will, you know, make them bigger than the sum of their parts, which is what Ange Postecoglou is doing, right? And why Richarlison looks a better striker in that system than he might do individually.
Sure. That's the communist system.
Yeah. The other thing is that if you've got players like Zlatan Ibrahimovic or Messi or Ronaldo, then you don't...
The billionaire's system.
Yeah. You don't need to worry too much about like solving problems in a structural sense because you have individuals who can solve those problems as well. So yeah, this is not me wanting to come here and say, you know, all teams should only ever do this. But, you know, for some teams where they don't have elite creative and productive players... both in terms of generating chances, but also getting them away and scoring them. The best way of overcoming that is to make sure you have a system that allows you to get the most out of players who maybe aren't at that sort of a level, elite level of finishing or creativity.
Yeah. I always think it's very annoying that all the best strikers play at the best teams because you can never really tell how much better they are. You know, I wish Haaland and Messi did play for teams, you know, at the bottom of the Premier League and La Liga, or even in League Two, you know, and then we could really see how good they were, John. That would present something interesting to you from a data perspective, wouldn't it?
I think so. And coming back to Erling Haaland, like the reason why he's such a cheat code in that respect is because he plays a very sort of traditional striker role. And those guys who do that, they don't need to really do a huge amount, right? They have to be good finishers. They have to get in good positions. They have to be physical enough to get the chances. So Chris Wood, in my data set, because I've only logged him when he's been at Forest this season, he's just got an incredible return of investment in terms of what he's actually doing because he's scoring a ton of goals. But there's no one out there who's realistically saying, well, Chris Wood should be playing for one of the elite teams.
It sounds like that's what you're saying.
Yeah. No, I mean, part of that is to
you think you think Pep Guardiola should sign him up in the summer?
Yeah, well, I mean, the difference between Chris Wood and Erling Haaland, and this is why I wouldn't recommend that Guardiola sign Chris Wood this summer, is that at the moment, Chris Wood is clearly going through a purple patch, right, where just finishes are coming off every time for him. The reason why Erling Haaland is such a dangerous goal scorer is because he has the physicality to be able to
his whole life is a purple patch.
Yeah, exactly. He has the physicality, like we said, to get those shots away really quickly without compromising on his shooting action. And that means that when you're playing for a team like Man City, if they can generate those kind of chances that you score, he's just going to score more than anyone else playing that kind of role. That comes down to like his physicality and his athletic ability to score these chances. He's quicker, he's stronger, he's taller, etc. So all of those things go towards him just being a super, super dangerous goal scorer. But yeah, in terms of comparing him to someone who's maybe a bit more aesthetically pleasing to watch, right? Obviously, people are going to choose Messi or Ronaldo or whoever for you know, game-changing moments where they pick the ball up in midfield and then fashion something with it. But with Haaland, it's just there's an extent to which, you know, it's aesthetically pleasing to see someone who is what you would develop in a lab if you wanted a goal scorer, right? It's a different kind of aesthetic, and a lot of it's down to do with repetition and the fact that he just does the right thing all the time almost. This season, actually, and this is the thing, right? This season he's had, relatively speaking, quite a poor season in front of goal, despite the fact that he is the top goal scorer in the Premier League right now. But in watching through all of his shots, he missed a lot of sitters this season, which he didn't do last season, which is why he scored whatever it was, 52 goals in the calendar year or something like that across the course of the season.
I have to say, I think however many iconic goals he scores, the most iconic thing that Erling Haaland ever did and will ever do, I think this is true. I remember reading about it somewhere that he drove around Dortmund with his car windows down, really loudly playing the Champions League anthem and singing along. What a strange guy.
I mean, that's elite in its own way, right?
It's so great. Yeah. Okay, listen, that's Erling Haaland. He's good. Yep. Big fucking whoop, man. 40 minutes of a podcast. Come on, John. Get your game face on. Ollie Watkins. Tell me about Ollie Watkins, because Aston Villa, there were all these stories that went around at the, you know, halfway through last season, that were, we told Watkins to just play in the box and then he started scoring more goals instead of going wide, and it's like we've fixed football. It did seem to work for him, didn't it? Has that been reflected in your data collection with him?
Yeah, Ollie Watkins is an interesting one because, like you say, I think they've definitely worked on getting him into those more dangerous goal-scoring situations. Ollie Watkins is a player who originally was playing as a wide forward, and he does have a tendency to have that creep into his game as well. So you'll often see him picking the ball up in channels and running in a diagonal towards goal and getting shots away. But I think Unai Emery's really worked with him on making sure that he is, again, that number nine who's in the place where you want your number nine to be, because the rest of the team are trying to get the ball into that kind of space. But I've highlighted him actually in the notes because he's not a particularly quick striker. So when it comes to touches per shot, he's like mid-table, he's ninth. In our two-touch timing metric, he's, where is he here? Quite far down, 17th. Okay, so for two-touch shots, he's averaging around 1.14 seconds per two-touch shot. So, and again, it's worth saying that like the two-touch shot sample size is pretty small sample size, so you know, take it with a pinch of salt. I'm not surprised that Erling Haaland shows up comfortably the quickest on that metric, but I wouldn't like set my stock in where players are finishing. But Ollie Watkins is getting a lot of goals this season, and he's not getting a lot of goals through having the ability to take those shots, those two touch shots, really quick. But I think that he's an interesting one because you do get that aspect of like good coaching can actually produce more goals in him. So maybe another area where Aston Villa could benefit from him is just trying to get him taking those shots a little bit quicker, perhaps seeing if they can increase his shot timing, see whether or not that actually changes things. There was a goal against a team a few weeks ago, and I can't remember the team off the top of my head, but he gets a really quick shot away, and a result of that shot is that it goes past quite close to the keeper. It looks like the keeper should maybe save it, but it's because the rhythm of the shot is so quick that the keeper's thought, oh, I've got a bit more time to set myself, and then the shot's coming and he's like, I think maybe it was against Spurs actually, he hasn't had time to properly set himself, and so the ball goes in past him. So I think that's an area that we could look at for that. But I also think it's worth saying you don't need to be super quick to be a high volume goal scorer, right? You don't need to necessarily get your shots away as quickly as possible. There are going to be other ways of being able to do that. One of those will be, you know, the ability to be in behind defenses and play the ball around goalkeepers. That's a really important like mechanic to be able to score. So again, I'm wanting to avoid people from coming away from this and just being like, the best strikers are all the ones who can get the shots away quickest. Actually, there's going to be some strikers who are going to have different skill sets that are based on different, you know, shooting mechanics, different situations in the game. The reason why I say that is that I think coming out of this at the end of that process of saying how important is timing to shooting, the answer that I get is, you know, it's like anything. If you can make it work for yourself, it's really important. And there's always marginal gains to be found, I think, in trying to improve the speed of your shooting mechanic as a striker. But that doesn't mean to say that if you're not quick, that you can't also be a high volume goal scorer, because there's other factors that come into it. And I think that's almost what I wanted to do coming in from a position where I was like, it feels as though with expected goals metrics being so widespread, people just say, oh, as long as you're in the right position to score, you're going to be fine. There are always like other factors that come into it. And you should always assess every one of these metrics. So timing, touches taken, whatever other metrics we're going to look at, in the context of actually what is this player trying to do, what is their team trying to do, why might it be the case that they're such a good goal scorer at the Premier League level. So yeah, I thought Ollie Watkins was kind of an interesting example from that point of view.
We're talking data safety, people, right? We're talking about getting those binary gloves on, handling it with care. Not trying to get big, you know, sexy headlines out of stuff. Trying to keep it as boring as possible. That's what you're saying, right?
The more information you have on things, the more you can learn about, the better context you have to learn from it. And I would say that's definitely true with this. Is there certain strikers who you look at and look at the data and you're like, I understand why their data looks this way.
Have you ever tried, though, hearing something, just reading it wherever, not checking the source, thinking, oh, that sounds good and right, and then just saying that to other people? Because I've tried that, and it works really well for me in social scenarios.
It's tempting to do that. I think it's quite easy to do that in my position, because like if you come up with a good take, you have then a whole season for that take to sort of exist.
Yeah.
And there's a tendency to just be like, my take is going to be good forever, right? Like, I don't know. Arsenal are
Arsenal
are bad at build-up, which they were at the beginning of the season. Maybe it's changing now, right? And so is it going to be the case that I'm going to just be a little bit too slow responding to the improvements they make in their build-up play, for example?
What's the worst take you've ever had that at the time you were convinced was right, and retrospectively, even though you can look back and go, yeah, look, some of the context was correct when I was saying it, I missed this thing or I missed that element of information that I now have that changes my opinion about it because obviously I was wrong and I'm a bad, bad boy.
I've never done that.
I'm always right.
Seriously though, the answer is probably Trent Alexander-Arnold as a six, because I think that my criticisms were correct, but my criticisms were too narrow-minded that I wasn't considering the fact that what actually ended up happening. So I think Trent Alexander-Arnold, they started playing as a sort of classic inverted fullback and it didn't really work. And so for me, I was like, okay, this is a sign that the project has failed. But obviously Liverpool have been good since that happened. And I think the reason why it's worked out is because they've changed the role that Alexander-Arnold is playing so that the sorts of things that are being expected of him are quite different actually from what you would expect from a classic inverted fullback, and it's working really, really well for them. So yeah, it's a case of just my worldview being too small and realizing that actually it's not just about the tactical theory being imposed on things. It's actually that the coaches can be like, well, let's just tweak the tactical theory. And then you're like, oh yeah, I guess I didn't really think about that.
I didn't think about it was in the real world. Yeah. Mine is that I thought that Wes Hoolahan was better than Messi.
Wesley.
But just turns out that Emi Buendia was and not Wes Hoolahan. I was one generation out.
Yeah.
You know, what can you do? Hey, here's another one. Did you know people always misuse this? But you know the word factoid? It actually means a fact that is commonly believed to be true but isn't true. But people use it because they think it means a small fact. fact could be smaller than another.
But I guess facts can be smaller, right? You can have small
can
facts.
They? Big... Aren't yeah, facts yeah, yeah. all equal? If they're a fact is a level of totality. If it is a fact, it is totally accurate, right? How can something be more totally accurate than something else? Can't be. It is a fact that I am here as the host of this episode today, right? It's also a fact that you're the host of this podcast. Does that mean, is one bigger than the other? Is one, I mean, one is better than the other, but is one is one more, I mean, one is... One
I would say that you are a bigger fact than me. I am a smaller fact to you. Yeah. I don't think anyone's disagreeing with
that. A lot more facts around the middle. I think that's what you're...
to be honest, I'd describe you as a factoid, to be honest.
Yeah, I am a factoid. Yeah. I'm a fat toad. Didn't really pay off at the end there, did it?
No.
What a shame.
You tried, though.
Let's talk about some other teams now. You mentioned Darwin Núñez before. Mm-hmm. Is it Núñez or Núñez? Has he got the...
It's a Núñez. He has the Tildilla? No, it's not that, is it? Tilda.
The Tilda?
I think it's called Tilda.
The Tilda Swinton?
The Tilda Swints.
Okay. Yeah. Darwin Núñez. You talked about him before. He's kind of, at times... I'm someone who, this season, as you know, I've been sort of a little bit more outside of the day-to-day football grind, a.k.a. I haven't been watching football. So what I'm picking up through the lens of friends talking about it, seeing discussion online, Darwin Núñez seems to kind of oscillate between just a figure of mockery and then, you know, one of the great strikers in the Premier League. I can't really put my finger on where he is. Can you contextualise that with your shot and timing talk?
Yeah, like the original... prompting for the whole research was whether or not timing actually influenced or informed the debate at all. And having watched through all of Erling Haaland's chances this season that are non-headed and not penalties, and also Darwin Núñez's, I think the conclusion that I've come to is that Darwin Núñez is a very good footballer, but he's bad at finishing. It's just as simple as that. I don't know how else you quantify it, but I suppose with Darwin Núñez, he's similar to Haaland in that his like insane athleticism gets him into really good goal scoring positions. And the reason why Darwin Núñez is Erling Haaland is like a generationally good goal scorer is because when he gets into those positions, he scores more. Darwin Núñez is a little bit more erratic when it comes to the finishing, and I'm sure there are reasons why if you broke it down biomechanically, which is something that I would never do unless I was aided by a biomechanics expert. But I'm sure that's the level at which your analysis needs to take place. Although I would say one thing, and what that one thing is that I noticed that with Darwin Núñez, he's very one-dimensional in the types of chances that he's creating. Maybe I should say three-dimensional, because I think there's three different types of chances that he generally generates and takes. And this is a really good, as an aside, this is a really good reason to just watch all of a player's shots from a season in a row, because you start picking up on like repeated tendencies. And I think he was very one-dimensional in that respect. So he has the shot, you know, the two that he scored against Newcastle, where he's wide and he pulls it back across the goalkeeper into the far corner on his right-hand side. He's really good at those chances.
Reverse Messi.
Yeah. He scored one against Norwich this weekend, I think, doing exactly that thing. The other thing that he does is like the standard playing as a nine, getting in between, you know, in behind back nines. Salah sets him up and he taps it in or yeets it over, depending on what kind of day it is. The other thing he does is he often plays as a left forward, right? A little bit deeper. And what he does in those situations a lot is that he picks the ball up, cuts in on the diagonal onto his stronger right foot, and he wants to get to the edge of the box and then try and curl it into the top corner from the edge of the box. And beyond that, like, most of his chances like fit those three different buckets. And I think there's maybe a sense that he's difficult to defend from a pure athleticism point of view. But maybe he's a little bit easier to defend in terms of a creativity point of view. So you know what he's going to do beforehand, and you can sort of take steps to make it harder for him to do that. Again, like,
because the defenders are going to prep, and also they might not watch 500 of his shots, but they're going to watch, you know, his performances in the last few games, right?
If you know that he's coming in on the diagonal from the left, and he's going to try and shoot with his right, you just make sure that that shot isn't on, and you take the consequences if he moves onto his left and does something with it, because he probably won't be as good. Same again with the shot back across the goalkeeper. If you know that's what he's going to try and do, and the reason why he's so good at it is because he's athletically good enough to get around defenders and take the shot anyway, so there's nothing they can do about it, right? So there's an element of the iron robin about this, but I do think that that's
sense to me, because this is exactly how I play against you in Rocket League. I know it's okay to overcommit in an attacking phase, because I know if I leave the goal open and you have the ball and there's no defender, you're going to miss anyway. So it doesn't matter. There's no need for me to defend you in any way at all. But I only know that because I've prepared by playing 500 games against you.
No comment. But that's the same sort of principle. But yeah,
fine.
Darwin Núñez, a fantastic striker who has finishing issues, which I think everyone knew. So again, another profound finding in my research.
52 minutes into the podcast. Now, Rasmus Højlund. This is interesting because we haven't seen that much of him yet, and he's settling into what is, let's be honest, a rubbish team. Tell me about Højlund.
Højlund is interesting because I think, according to this timing data, he profiles probably closest to Erling Haaland. You know, the same kind of striker, right? He's a classic number nine.
Same kind of name, sounds the same.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I'm with you.
They started off with the name and then they filled in the rest of the details.
Sure.
But yeah.
The FM regens are really not putting in the effort that they used to, rather.
Yeah. But yeah, we know that Højlund has struggled to score in the Premier League this season. And I think a big part of that is, you know, he scored goals in European competitions, not so much in the Premier League. And I think a lot of people would take that information and be like, well, clearly he's just not good enough for the Premier League. But I think that because he profiles so similarly to, you know, players of the profile of Højlund and Richarlison, that you're completely dependent on the team generating the sorts of chances that you're going to get.
It's a service issue.
I think it's a service issue with him. But I think that stands him in really good stead, right? Because his numbers are decent. And I think that, you know, he's one of those, he is a penalty box striker. If you can develop a system which is consistently and repeatedly finding him in those areas, he's going to start scoring, you know, high volume goals. So it's one of those things where Man United have made the right decision in the transfer market, but the problem is that they aren't able to actually derive the benefits of that decision.
Because they made five other bad ones.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah. So. Okay, that's interesting. He's got that explosiveness, hasn't he? And I like how he makes that constipated face when he's doing an action, and how his little hair flops around like that too. So hopefully we'll get to see him banging him in a bit more. Nicholas Jackson's another interesting player, new to Chelsea, and again, like a lot of the same sort of conversation.
Yeah,
actually quite a lot of similar conversations about all Premier League top six strikers this season, haven't there?
Yeah, so Nicholas Jackson, I think, is interesting from the point of view that he was, until very recently, a wide forward. And so if you look at his data, he's very low down on the touches per shot metric, because obviously he likes to receive the ball in deeper areas and try and beat players, getting behind that way. And I think, you know, a lot of people would be just like, well, Nicholas Jackson's terrible in front of goal. But interestingly enough, he shows up third on my two-touch timing metric. So you've got Erling Haaland at number one with 0.7, and then down at third, you've got Nicholas Jackson at 0.81. So very, very close in sort of timing to Erling Haaland. And I think that would surprise a lot of people. Now, again, sample size issues, because he doesn't have a huge amount of two-touch shots to base that on. But the suggestion there is that actually, if you can get Nicholas Jackson into these sorts of positions where he's able to take these two-touch chances, you are going to get the benefit of him being able to get his shots away earlier. Now, he has missed a lot of high-value chances close to the goal. So, again, it could be an example of someone who's shooting too quick for their shooting mechanic. So maybe the solution here is getting him to slow down his shooting technique in these sorts of areas as well. But I thought that was kind of interesting, because I think a lot of people have responded to the stuff that I put out and been like, well, obviously Chelsea are going to be like super low down on the shot timing thing. And yes, in general, he is wanting to pick the ball up and run at players. But actually, when you get him into those two-touch scenarios that you want your striker to be in, he is actually getting the shots away quite quickly. So that's one thing to check out, I think, when he's taking those two-touch chances. Do we think that he's snatching at shots because he's trying to get them away too quick? Again, could the solution there be just take your time a little bit more and make sure you hit the target?
Okay. And the final player you have on your list here is Odson Edouard.
Yeah, he's the player who I think after Richarlison maybe stood out to me the most. And he stood out to me the most initially just on the rewatch of his shots. Because I just think he's a really, really fantastic 1-2-touch striker who is playing for a team who generally are going to not give him a huge amount of 1-2-touch chances. So
I remember when he joined Palace, and like those first few games, I remember being super impressed by how quickly he got shots away.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem is I spoke to Baby Boy Pinder about this,
right?
Because as we know, he's a Palace fan, and I was just sort of like, what's the general Palace consensus on Odson Edouard?
What's the Palace consensus? Like, yeah. You're writing to Buckingham Palace.
Yeah. And he said, well, yeah, Charles III is a real fan. But yeah, Meghan Markle, not so much.
Sure.
And he said to me, good finisher, but like doesn't really do anything else that well. And I'm like, well, surely this is the sort of player that you need in a number nine side. Like, doesn't obviously, if you're a team like Palace, who maybe aren't going to generate as many good chances in the box, you want someone who's going to be able to do link-up play a little bit better to make the ball stick, etc. But surely he's the sort of player that you want when you do create those situations where, you know, you want to score a goal. You're not going to have many of those situations. You can be sure that he's probably going to be able to finish them. And there's just a lot of shots.
It sounds like you gave it to Pinder with two fists. It sounds like you really put him in his place.
Yeah, I wanted to. I really, really.
What you did is
home.
You went to him, your colleague in a professional office space, and you said, "What do you think about this thing that you're passionate about?" And he told you, and then you went, "You're wrong."
That's right. So the sample size that I've got for Odson Edouard is 29 shots, but he scored 6 goals in that time, which is a pretty good rate of return for that amount of shots on my data. And it's just like when I was watching through the chances, I was just like every chance where I was like, "He's really got to do well with this." He did well with it. There's a lot of stuff where he's like picking the ball up outside the box and take it. Interestingly, he's like when he's setting himself outside the box, he's quite slow and cumbersome. But actually, when he is in those scenarios where he has to get the shot away quickly, he does it really quickly. So he's second on the two-touch timing list after Erling Haaland.
Is he a player then that you think could move, you know, like could be deserving of a move to a club that might be able to provide those opportunities more? What's the perfect team in the Premier League for Odson Edouard?
Spurs.
Spurs.
Because they're generating those one or two touch chances, and I think he's much more consistent at finishing them than Richarlison is. And he's
did you recommend him
in
your sensible transfers episode?
I didn't know, but I'd done Why the not? Spurs. I'd done the Spurs one, but we didn't do strikers. I don't think, did we?
Oh, okay.
I don't think we did, but I definitely would have done had I done the research by that point.
I like that. Spurs
it's fun,
fans,
isn't it?
Go watch Odson Edouard. Yeah, that sounds fun. Yeah.
But yeah, another example of a player who maybe is a little bit undervalued because they're not a well-rounded profile. But when it comes to, okay, stick him in a team where you don't need to be a well-rounded profile, like Richarlison, and then you'd probably see him feast in those in that context.
Did he come from Celtic?
Celtic.
No.
Yeah, so, but he didn't overlap with Ange Postecoglou. So, but okay. Again, that would have been an interesting one, right? If we'd have seen Edouard under Ange at Celtic.
Oh, I like that link. Okay, fine. Do you want to do the training ground bit? Or I feel like you already did that.
Yeah, I think we've talked a lot about how you can action all of this stuff. But yeah, the takeaway I guess I would want everyone to leave with is this idea that when it comes to like analysing finishing and shooting actions, that the more information that we have about those actions, the better. Obviously, shot location is going to be the biggest predictor of a team's goal scoring. But I think that the more information you have on the context and the kind of shots and the timings that you've got for individual strikers, the better place you are going to be to actually be able to assess how dangerous those strikers are in front of goal. And I would recommend, look, scouts do this already, right? Analysts do this already. I've had a few people from a few different clubs come to me and say, really great to see you doing this work, because this is what we are doing at clubs right now, and a lot of this isn't in the wider conversation in the mainstream media. Far be it from me to say scouts go out there and make sure you're tracking these sorts of things, but it's definitely changed my view on how to evaluate strikers and just given me a much better sense of, like, rather than just going, oh well, this guy overperforms his XG, this guy underperforms it. Actually, I think we can interrogate those figures and be like, is this player underperforming their XG because they're not getting shots away quick enough? So those chances are being slightly overvalued by the models, etc. Is this player shooting too quickly? Is that why they're not actually being able to get the benefit of the chances they're finding?
That's cool. Well, thanks for your opinion. And to add to that, my valuable takeaway from this would be La Porchetta, which is a lovely Italian restaurant in North London. They do delightful margaritas and profiteroles, and they have recently started doing takeaway, delivery even, not even just takeaways. And I get them away to my house. Timing very, very efficient. Yeah. I would say anywhere between 14 minutes and 20. Sometimes a little longer if it's a Friday or a Saturday night. But I'm always left satisfied after scoffing one of them and a thing of chips and a whole thing of profiteroles. And sometimes a Coke Zero. So if you take anything away from this podcast, take it from La Porchetta. John, thank you for your time today.
I would just like to say that in a bid to justify me spending so much time logging all of that data, and I am going to log the data for the rest of the season, I am going to make my data available free to use for people. So if there's any analysts out there, fanalists in particular, who want to get hold of it, then it will be, once I've mined it for all it's worth, it will be available to people, so do check that out.
You really are a hero, aren't you? You're
the people's hero.
The people.
The goblins.
Also a hero of... I can't remember what it was. But I hope the goblin community can find some use in the data when they take a break from mining the magical ores that they have to mine on a day-to-day basis.
Well, thank you for interviewing me and asking the questions that I wrote out very admirably.
Sure. Sure. I did a good job of making it sound fun, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. Yeah, I think some people may have been tricked into thinking it was fun because you introduced it, right? I wonder if those people are still here now.
No, no one's here now. No one's here now. And to no one, we'll see you again next week. Thanks, John. Bye.
Bye.